meeting and they broke your blocks on the day.
Well, we need to make sure that's a third.
I'll call this meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. And note that present are Representatives Gruenberg, Pettyjohn, Phillips, Coxon, and Miller Chair. The two other members have indicated they're going to be tied up with other bills, other committees, but we'll get here as soon as possible. We have a number of bills before us today, and these same bills will be before the House, before this committee tomorrow morning as well. The meeting tomorrow morning will convene at 9. And we have before us, and this is the order in which we'll be considering this legislation, but I'll make an explanation about that a little bit later too. The order in which we'll officially, hear the legislation will be Senate Bill 29, an act relating to domestic violence and domestic sexual offenses. Senate Bill 28, an act relating to training state employees and certain employees of the districts of the state public school system on the recognition and reporting of child abuse and neglect. House Bill 308, an act relating to criminal background checks. House Bill 67, an act relating to hearsay evidence and prosecution for certain sexual offenses. And House Bill 88, an act relating to the protection of children. As I say, we'll be more or less taking those bills up in that order. However, these are a lot of bills that people have expressions that they want to make on several of them, I'm sure. So as a result, both in the testimony that people give here at the table and also on the teleconference network, the chair will allow wide latitude for people to testify on more than one bill if they wish to do so. My only very firm request is that any person that does that, please identify each bill separately as you give testimony. There's a certain amount of overlapping interest in all of them, and it can get very confusing if people are just aren't testifying on which bill they're talking about specifically. Mr. Gruenberg?
Mr. Chairman, may I request that we take all testimony first before we start marking stuff up?
Oh, absolutely. No, we're not going to do any markup today, and we might get into some early markup on what we've been considering the easy bills tomorrow. But yes, we will hear testimony on all of those bills before we start marking up. And for that reason, I would particularly request members in their questions that they ask witnesses to ask questions that perhaps lead to your understanding of what they are saying, but not necessarily to an immediate markup type situation. With that brief explanation, we'll first take up, as I say officially, but we can certainly talk about other things as we go along, Senate Bill 29. The prime sponsor of that legislation, Senator Fakes, is present. And Senator, if you'd like to join us at the table and talk about this bill and, for that matter, the other Senate bill, if you're so inclined.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jan Fakes. I represent South Anchorage Midtown in the Alaska State Senate. I appreciate the courtesy of the chairman for bringing up these bills for committee's consideration and the opportunity to testify before you today. And I appreciate being allowed to be first because I'm probably supposed to be at four different things right now. Senate Bill 29, let me tell you, I put together a package of three bills for the consideration of the legislature this session, 27, 28, 29. And we looked over what was in the statutes and what was happening in the real world on child abuse, as far as training goes, reporting, definitions, that kind of thing. And we brought together a task force made up of council members, attorneys in Anchorage, the AG's office, just various people, as many people as we could think of that dealt with this subject matter on a daily basis, continual basis in their livelihoods and everyday workplace. And we looked for things that needed fixing, a Band-Aid approach maybe, but we were looking things that could be done that cost very little money or no money, but could repair some things that needed fixing in the criminal code or in procedural codes or in the way state governments operate. And 29 was one of those items that we found, in talking to the court system and in talking to people that deal with child abuse and families that have this encountering, we realized that possibly the definition of domestic violence needed to be broadened. Now, I'm not talking about section number one. Senator Halford will speak to that section, I'm sure, himself. And I have no objections to that system of court, section, of course, and the Senate didn't either. But sure. But that's not my level of expertise. My level would be in the definition for domestic violence. We were finding, and the experts were finding in the field, that under the definition of domestic violence, people in a spousal relationship with the perpetrator or the person who's creating the violence could go to court and ask for an injunction or whatever the legal terminology is to have immediate relief of some type. And we were finding that the people who really needed some of that immediate relief, quick fix by the court, were grandparents, were the children, actually, that maybe it was their spouse, but they were living in a different home. Basically, there were a lot of situations out there that were not given the opportunity in a domestic violence situation. It was clearly domestic violence to go to the court and request an injunction and some kind of immediate relief before the whole process could be worked through. So basically, the bill expands the definition of domestic violence to allow for parent, grandparent, or child of the person who committed the crime, not necessarily in a spousal relationship, to be included, and it would be a minor child in the situation. Now, in doing this, in Section 5 at the time, the Attorney General's office asked for Section 5 to be included in there, and I had agreed at the time, but since then, checking through and talking to individuals who actually have direct contact in these cases, including a judge, they have agreed, and Representative Gruendorf, this was one of your concerns and problems. They said that Section 5 is not necessary, that it actually would limit or restrict the child's ability to petition the court. So with that, I'd like to hand the committee a request and a memo from me requesting that Section 5, if you deem it appropriate, be removed from the bill after your deliberations and you go through and debate. And with that, Mr. Chairman, that's all I have to say on Senate Bill 29.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask
Mr. Greenberg.
Senator, that was going to be one of my questions. I'm looking now at the language on page 2, lines 15 through 17, the underlined portion. I will, at the proper time, propose an amendment to strike that. And that's what you're talking about, Senator. Okay. Mm-hmm. Number two, I had planned to introduce an amendment. May I just give this out so that we can discuss these? And I talked to the senator about this at lunch, which would empower the court to appoint a guardian ad litem in these domestic violence cases so that the child would have independent representation where these explosive situations, and they really do need that. And from what I understand, you do not have but that would retain, it would go at the end of, it would be in place of the underlined language in Section 5, and I assume you have no problem with that.
I have no problem with it. I would have to bow to the AG's office, and okay. Those of you who are in the legal profession to tell me whether it fits and it's good, but the idea is good, and I think it's needed, and I would welcome that as a friendly amendment to this bill.
Now, yesterday we took considerable testimony in the Hess Committee. Nobody can say that the House has delayed consideration of this bill. And we got some testimony from all over the state, and probably some people on the line now who unfortunately may not have gotten the chance to testify. I just don't know. But some of the people who did testify made specific suggestions, and I'd like to ask you about a couple of them. If we look on page 1, line 27, after the word child, somebody suggested adding or grandchild. And the same language on page 2, line 21, after the word child, adding or grandchild, so that a grandchild would also be protected, as well as we now have parents, grandparents, children, but we don't have grandchildren. And this is what somebody else had testified about. Do you have any feelings about that?
No, I really don't. I'd have to bow to the wisdom of the committee on that. There's got to be ramifications for that. You're not adding nieces and nephews.
Right.
I think your laundry list could be expanded greatly, and of course that's what the legislative process is for. So I would have to bow to the wishes of this committee.
Okay. Okay, and that is it. I may deal with another thing, but I will talk with you first, and I'm not at all certain that, and I don't even want to even get into that. And some of the other people here, could you concern to mediation?
Let me, if I may, Mr. Chairman, add one thing. What we did is we tried to get some statistical data to say what was missing the most, what were the most urgent needs, what were the, who were the types of folks involved in domestic violence that needed to have relief, that immediate relief from the court, that weren't getting it. And so that's how we created our list. And to the best of my knowledge, grandchildren did not surface in that research.
It wasn't something I thought of either, and I'm simply mentioning, and Representative Pettijohn and Representative Taylor were there. I think I was maybe even outside the room talking to Senator Halpert at the time. You guys may remember what the testimony was on grandchild. I don't even
know. One of the ladies specifically testified. One of the ladies on the teleconference testified that one of the worst cases of child abuse that she'd seen in her experience, and I believe she was from Kodiak, if I'm not mistaken, was a case involving a grandchild being kept by the grandparents. And she said, it looks like you have a hole there in your bill, and you might want to at least put the word grandchild in. So, that's what it came
from. Mr. Clark, your question. Senator Fakes, I want to ask you a tactical question. This bill was amended on the floor of the Senate. If the House makes any amendments, it has to go back to the Senate for concurrence. What's your judgment of the danger in that procedure?
So, generally speaking, you're asking me to ask what my 19 fellow senators would do, and that's always very dangerous to try to predict. Generally, in the Senate, concurrence is based on the wishes of the prime sponsor. The prime sponsor signs off on those amendments made by the other body, then the membership of the Senate, as a courtesy matter, will vote for the bill. If you're talking specifically about Section 1, Senator Halpert's the prime sponsor of that particular section, so you would have to ask his, if there was any movement to remove that, you would have to ask Senator Halpert what the purpose of the Senate would be. But if you made technical amendments in mine, and at the same courtesy and same agreement and communication level that has gone on thus far, I have no reason but to concur in those amendments and would ask my fellow members to concur in them.
Jan, I will be offering an amendment in this committee, and I'd like your response to it as a legislator, a woman, and a wife. It would add a new section which states, in Section 1.
You can answer that in three separate parts.
Right.
I had no idea this committee was like this.
Oh, we have lots of fun.
This is unique.
The amendment would read as follows. The presumptive terms set forth in subsections 1 to 4 above do not apply when the victim was the legal spouse of the defendant unless the spouses were living apart or the defendant caused physical injury to the victim. What this would do would mean that where the spouses are living together and there was no physical injury, it would be entirely to the discretion of the judge what sentence would be imposed in a marital rape. He would have the ability to sentence them up to 30 years, or he would, but he would not be required under the bill as it stands right now. The judge is required to give a presumptive 8-year term on the first offense. Now, to me, the reason I offer this amendment, and will offer it, is that I believe there is a qualitative difference between a rape by a man who is married and living together with a woman as opposed to some stranger who grabs some lady off the streets and drags her into an alley and rapes her. Now, I'm not saying that they aren't both crimes. They're both crimes, and they're both the same crime, sexual assault in the first degree. But when it's at sentencing, to me, the distinction is important enough to give the judge the latitude in sentencing, and I'd like your reaction to that.
Spoken like a true man.
I gather that was your response as a woman. Would you?
Try legislator.
In any event, if I am successful in having this amendment placed in either this committee or the floor, what's going to happen then?
Where is Senator Halpert when I need him? He's never around when I need. Okay, this is to get into the issue which I didn't want to get into. To me, there is no difference. You're raped. I don't care who does it. And just because you happen to have the unlucky facts to be married to the oaf doesn't mean it doesn't hurt as much physically or mentally. And a lot of the disaster that's done to anyone who's raped, male or female, is a mental injury. It's not a physical injury. Sometimes it is. That's brutal. But a lot of it is a mental injury, and how do you measure that? And how do you say, because you happen to be unlucky enough to be married to the creep, it hurts less?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Do we have further questions?
Read them first.
Senator, do you want to comment on 28 or...
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let's see here. Senate Bill 28. One of the loopholes that we found is, and it probably was just a communication problem between the various departments and things, is many of the departments had, first of all, state law requires very specifically that people have to report child abuse. State employees in those sensitive positions must report child abuse. And they have a legal obligation to report child abuse. But there was no mandatory training on how to get these folks educated in order to know about child abuse. And this bill closes that loophole. It mandates training. It specifically states those people that are state employees that have this responsibility both legally and morally to report this be given some training and some guidelines, that it be emphasized that they have some ability and some tools in order to make a wise and caring reporting.
Thank you very much. Do we have any questions from the committee on this? It's going to be the record report of the representative.
Mr. Chairman, am I excused?
No.
We've got one more question.
Senator, I haven't had a chance to read this very carefully, so I just skimmed it in the last 60 seconds. So if you answered my question, then I apologize. This requires that the training, this is page 2 now, 28 you're talking about, right?
28.
Right. Yeah. Requires that the training curriculum and materials be filed with a council on domestic violence. Goes on to say any department may seek the technical assistance of the council or the Department of Health and Social Services in the development of its training program. Knowing nothing more than I learned in my 60-second review, could you explain what appears to be at least a matter of confusion with regard to who's responsible?
Okay, I hadn't read the House Committee substitute, and I would have to ask Representative Gruenberg if did that language come over from the Senate like that? Did you change any of that?
I'm showing up, Alvin.
Yes. Help!
If that's House language, I apologize for asking you. I can wait for a later witness.
Let me tell you the intent.
What was the question? We can't find my file.
Oh.
This is without a horse.
Let me tell you the intent.
May Nancy Bennett say something? She's the staff assistant who worked on this. Go ahead. Okay.
She can identify with the child's language or sentence. Yeah.
Yes. The only change that was made in Section 2 and 3, the language was put specifically into the education statutes.
Okay, so the language that I'm concerned about apparently did come from the Senate. The senator is shaking her head for Representative Gruenberg's information. My question is on page 2, lines 4 through 8. It is not clear to me who is going to implement this training. You've got to file the curriculum and materials with the council. Any department may seek the technical assistance of the council or the Department of Health and Social Services.
When the bill was originally written, we envisioned it that the council would direct, manage, and be the overall head of this training. Quite frankly, there were turf battles going on. Each department felt like they had a training program. Maybe they didn't emphasize it. Maybe it wasn't out there as open as it should be. They wanted to manage their own training. And so we bought off on that, and we said, that's fine. Okay, each department, you're on record that if you have folks there that are responsible for reporting child abuse, then you must have a training program into effect, and you must emphasize it. They agreed on that. What we want the council to do is each department that's involved in this has a representative on the council to begin with. And so it may be cumbersome the way it's written, and it change it to make it more clear, is that the council would compile and have on record these various training programs. They're all members of the council. Maybe they can learn from each other. Maybe public safety would have a training program that the council would find that would be useful to Health and Social Services, and they could discuss it there. But they have to have a depository for all the various trainings, have somebody look at it, and if there's useful information there that can be learned and used by another department, that would be done in council meetings.
If I can continue, Mr. Chairman, the short answer is in that each department does its own training,
yes,
and the council is the clearinghouse.
Yes.
And I understand the turf battle involved. Have you considered the duplication and waste of effort of each department preparing its own training materials?
I just didn't seem to be able to win that battle on the Senate side.
Thank you. Do you have a further question? Mr. Pettit, your next question.
Senator, and Max, correct me if I'm wrong here, but have we not, in the bill, one of the bills we're working on, expanded greatly the people who are required to report suspected child abuse and neglect?
Yes, we
have. And I wonder,
yes.
I think we've expanded it rather markedly.
That's 308.
Right, and I wonder if we are going to, if that will have any fiscal impact on the Senator's bill here, because we have greatly broadened that.
Well, that would not have an impact.
I just wanted you to be aware of that.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That wouldn't have a fiscal note on this bill. That would have its own fiscal note.
Yeah, okay.
So it wouldn't make any difference in this bill at all.
Okay, all right.
Mr. Clarkson, incidentally, I'm going to try to rush along just a little bit because we have one person in Anchorage that has a time constraint, and so as soon as we're through with hearing from Senator Fakes, I'm going to switch to Anchorage briefly, and then we'll talk to Senator Halpin.
Senator, my file does not reflect a fiscal impact on this bill. Is there a zero fiscal note?
Yes, sir, there is a zero fiscal note.
By each of the departments?
Yes, by each of the departments.
Further questions, Senator Fakes, thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for the courtesy, members of the committee.
Thank you very much. Senator Halpert, do you want to join us at the table? As I mentioned earlier, because we do have at least one person in Anchorage that has a time problem, I think this is Francis Purdy. I'll switch to Anchorage, and then we'll come back and hear Francis Halpert's testimony. Anchorage, would you put Francis Purdy on, please?
This is not Francis Purdy. This is someone else, and I have a time constraint. I need to remain anonymous because our case is in court at the present time. I would like to speak on Bill number 67, and I would like to encourage that it be... I would like to encourage you to pass that. I also was disappointed that the section on hearsay testimony was deleted from House Bill 88. Our personal situation is that my 3.5-year-old daughter was sexually assaulted. The offender is charged with first-degree sexual assault. This occurred in January, and we sought immediate support and counseling for our daughter through the STAR agency in Anchorage, which was very helpful, and she's now under the care of a child therapist to help her cope with what has happened to her. Her therapy has been involved with helping her feel good about herself again, and it is not aimed at reliving this traumatic incident, but to help her feel good about herself again and to have more of a positive self-image. Our trial date is not set until June at the earliest. So almost 6 months later than the assault happened, my 3.5-year-old daughter will be required to remember and relive and be re-traumatized as to her assault. She may be unable to effectively testify due to the lack of memory, and that right now she is using repression as a tool to cope with what happened to her. If this happens, if she's not able to testify appropriately, this could lead to a guilty sexual offender being freed. And I need to remind you that almost every sexual offender will offend again if they are not treated appropriately. So I'm concerned that someone that is guilty is going to be freed and will assault another child. More so than that, my own daughter is going to have to suffer psychological and emotional setback because she will be required to testify in court. My concern is that there's so much protection and rights of the offenders that we've lost sight of the special considerations of victims in these cases, and in particular, innocent children, in particular, my 3.5-year-old daughter. We were misinformed by the police department. When my child gave her statements to the police, they were taped, and we were told that these tapes were admissible in court. That was not correct. Were we to have been informed in the beginning that she needed to do a deposition and be cross-examined with two attorneys present, we would have done that immediately while this was new in her mind and still an active part of her memory, but we were not informed. And so due to that, my child is in the process of recovery. She is getting better. However, she is going to have to be re-traumatized because of the way the legal system is set up at this point. I really recommend and I strongly encourage the passage of House Bill 67, and I would very much like to have seen it left in House Bill 88. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We greatly appreciate your testimony. Okay, I think Senator Halpert stepped out of the room. I just wondered if he's out there. He can come in now and be glad to hear him.
Excuse me, this is the moderator in Anchorage, and we have one other person here with a time constraint.
Let's do it then. Thank you very much.
She's approaching the mic at this time.
Representative Miller, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cecilia Kleinkopf. I'm here testifying today as an individual, as a social worker with a number of years of experience in child protective services. My comments are directed today at the committee substitute for House Bill 88. And I want to speak to my concerns about two or three particular sections of that bill, the first of which is Section 10 on page 4 of the bill. My concern here is that I believe that present law is adequate and necessary. In my opinion, the court should have to be notified, as is now provided for in statute, within the 12 hours, which is presently given also for the notification of the parent or guardian of a child taken into custody by the Department of Health and Social Services.
Excuse me.
Now permits 3.5 days to go by, a total of an initial 12 hours for the notification of the parent or guardian, an additional 24 hours that the department will have beyond the 12 hours, as I read the bill, to have to notify the court that it has taken a child into custody. And then added to that is the 48 hours now provided for in statute at which or within which the court has to set up the hearing for the custody of that child.
Excuse me, Ms. Pankow, could you tell us which bill are you on now? If you mentioned
House Bill 88.
I guess it's 88.
I'm sorry.
Ms. Pankow, Max,
go ahead,
Max. It's Section 10 on page 4, line 17 of House Bill 88, House version.
Correct.
Okay, thank you very much. Please continue. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No problem. My concern is that a total, this bill would permit a total of 3.5 days for the child to be in custody before the matter is heard before the court. I believe that 3.5 days is a very long time period in the life of a child, where a child may not have adequate understanding of what is going on. In my opinion, the present law is adequate and should be retained, the law that requires the court to be notified within the same 12-hour period that the Department of Health and Social Services has to notify the parent or guardian of the child. That's my first area of concern. If it's satisfactory with the committee, I'll speak to the other couple of sections that I have concerns about, and then I will be available to answer any questions.
Okay, listen, why don't we take a question right now from Representative Grunberg, who wants to speak on that issue.
Thank you. Ms. Kleinkopf, that was not our intent. I don't think that that's the way the thing is written. And we've got Commissioner John Pugh here and Connie Sipe from the department who worked on the bill. And that's not our intent. They will be dealing with that. Are you certain that you have the present version of the bill? Committee substitute for House Bill 88, Hess?
Yes, I do.
We'll have to give you an answer, but I don't believe that that's correct. Mr. Chairman, could Ms. Sipe come up and respond to that, please?
Yeah, okay. That'll be fine.
Thank you.
For the record, just to clear up, this is Deputy Commissioner Sipe. In the 410 bill, the language at page 4, lines 22 to 24, says that there would be up to 24 hours for the department to notify the court, and the 24 hours runs from the time custody is assumed, so it would be running simultaneously with the 12-hour period to notify the parents. Child picked up at hour 0, by 12 hours, parents must be notified, by 24th hour, court must be notified. Now, under a section that's not in the bill, but the current statute, at 4710, 142 subsection C, the court then, it shifts to the court to schedule a hearing, and that is 48 hours after the court is notified. So it is possible that by the time the court puts a hearing on, it could be 72 hours from the time custody is assumed. 24 hours for the department to notify the court, and the court 72 hours to schedule a hearing. In many of the jurisdictions of the state, the courts do not prefer to have these heard by weekend magistrates, but in fact by their family law judges who are not available on weekends. The courts often schedule them in one day, but the court schedules often require the 48 hours. That's the current status of how the bill interrelates with the statute.
Thank you very much. You can comment on that if you wish to, or else move on to your other area of concern.
But I believe you asked, suggests to me that the department could have 12 hours and could notify the parent on the 12th hour, and then the 24 hours for notification of the court ran after that. Deputy Commissioner Sipes seems to be saying that the 24 hours that the department has to notify the court includes the 12 hours that they have to notify the parents. And so in that case, perhaps I misread this section of the bill, but I was concerned about, seemed to me to be an extension of time for the department to notify the court.
Okay, well, we'll continue to keep an eye on that, too, and perhaps we can make it a little bit clearer. But why don't you go ahead with your other area of concern?
Sure. Representative Miller, we lost you. Just a moment.
Yeah. He's right here.
Yeah, is this better?
You're breaking up at this time.
You're breaking them up.
Check your cord.
This is the moderator. Do you know how I sound?
I'm sorry, we cannot understand you.
Okay, I'm going to hang up and read down the bridge.
How do you do that?
Okay.
What do you think about amendment, Randy? The real question is whether or not...
She didn't answer it more to run, I mean, other than...
Stanley, the record can show that everything good is good.
I've been here. I'll stand on the listening.
Early on, was it?
Oh. Presence. That's why I ran in, was to get a quorum for you. Gal told me you were short of quorum.
Would you ask Hal for anything?
I already have.
What he said? Would he rather no. Walk up this bill, he'd rather take...
Well, probably, she's probably got a time problem.
What's that?
He'd rather take the entire question.
But he's weaker on it. You know, he's not...
He's weakened on a great deal, though. He's almost the place where I think he can go on. If he doesn't like the idea, he can go on.
The problem was the amendment was offered out public hearing. The amendment was offered out public hearing. That's the problem. His amendment was offered to the floor of the Senate. 10 minutes, 15 minutes.
Let me get salary offered on. Yeah. He can wait. Where'd he go?
Okay, let's ask Senator Alford if he'd come on in. We're experiencing some technical difficulties here in Senator, why don't you join us and get us your testimony?
Yeah.
We're off the bridge of whatever the technical terminology is, so you don't have to worry about your name for the time being.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I am here on a portion of Senate Bill 29, particularly that portion that was added by amendment in the Senate, sections 1 and 2 dealing with the repeal of the prior statutory marital rape exemption, as well as the section which prohibits a common law defense in a marital rape case. I have spent a couple of years in looking at this in the committee structure and in the Senate side primarily after I left the House. I had many of the concerns that I've heard in debate on the legislation after I offered the amendment and immediately before I offered the amendment. I think the things that probably relieved my mind the most in those areas were the California study that was done after this legislation was passed, and a lot of the talk about numerous cases coming up and so forth just didn't happen. In California, they had, and they've had this law since 1980, they had one case per million of population per year. So it's not that in terms of prosecution, you're going to see a major issue here. There's several other things that I think are ancillary issues and should be looked at separately from the basic equal protection arguments that deal with whether people should be treated differently based on their marital status. I think the question or the statement that marital rape cases will be brought in the argument or will be part of the argument in a divorce case, maybe that's true. But then we should look at our divorce laws and we should fix it. We shouldn't maintain inequality in treatment before the law because of another problem. And I feel the same way about the mandatory sentencing question. If the mandatory sentencing system should be gone back and looked at, which I think maybe it should, then we ought to do that. But we shouldn't treat people inequitably because we don't want to further a problem that's already there. I think the language that came over from the House and from the Senate is as it needs to be. I agree with some of the concerns, particularly the concern in Section 5 of the original bill with regard to guardian ad litem and changes there. However, I think the easiest way to deal with that, to ensure the passage of the bill, would be to add the current Section 5 with a repealer of this language right behind it in your House Bill 88, so that you're changing this back immediately after it takes effect, and send this bill without any amendments to the governor. If, in fact, you pass the bill with no amendments, of course, it doesn't even come back to the Senate. I think...
Are you telling us that's an important thing to do?
Well, it might be an important thing to do. I think we could all go back and do some counting to look at the strategy of how that's handled. But I want to see the bill in law, and I do share the concerns in Section 5. The way to handle that could be to add the change in Section 5 to your House Bill 88, but to pass this bill exactly as it came from the Senate, then it wouldn't be even back for a concurrence. I think the Senate probably would concur with minor amendments and very well might concur with that amendment. I know the sponsor certainly concurs with it. But I'm just strictly speaking in terms of getting the legislation on the governor's desk without any opportunity to lose it.
I'm not sure we're on the same or not, but do the other members have questions?
Is there any kind of fiscal note on this, Rick? You did this on the floor.
There is no fiscal note.
Has anybody looked at it from that angle?
Well, the potential of a fiscal note would be one half case per year if the California example holds true.
And if the guy's convicted, he does 8 years, right? So there would be a fiscal impact, at least on corrections.
Well, he may not do 8 years. Mitigating circumstances could drop that to 4 years.
Where do I see that? Well, you know, what mitigating? I mean, just the present existing mitigating circumstances?
The rape sentence can be dropped to 4 years.
Okay, well, let's call it 6 then, all right? That's a fiscal impact, is it not?
I think you could consider that being that could be a fiscal impact. However, if you don't pass the bill, you may find other fiscal impacts that are far more extensive in what happens as a result of domestic violence. Inequality costs just as much, and in many cases more than equality.
It's going to cost the state.
Well, it costs us in the budget every year.
Further questions for Senator Hoffman? Well, we thank you very much for
thank you.
We need further counsel. Thank you. I keep punching this button here as if I was on the air. I don't know if I am or not, but I guess I'll keep on.
How do you ask if anything?
Well, he's talking right now. This is turned off. I'm pretty sure we're here. Okay, I was going to go to Anchorage and start hearing some testimony there, but I think we'll... If I could have the committee's attention on another matter for just 1 second here. it's something I should have announced at the beginning of the session, of this session, and it has nothing to do with the bills that are before us. This is regarding House Bill 294, the Alaska Hire Bill, which we passed out yesterday. Actually, with committee's concurrence, I'm formally withdrawing that letter of intent that was put on somebody's desk, simply because the bill speaks for itself, no letter of intent is necessary. And because the committee approves the findings and the conclusions in the bill as being well supported by the record. So for that reason, the letter of intent that we had circulated yesterday will not be called for a vote. It's intended to withdraw. Mr. Clausen.
Mr. Chairman, the question of a fiscal note concerns me. I'm anxious to get this bill passed. It does have a finance referral, and if we can establish a record here that it has no fiscal impact, then we can make that a referral avoided. In light of that, I wonder if we could call the IRS for that.
Oh, yeah, Gail, could you give us
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Gail Horetsky with the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. I'm afraid I didn't hear.
The question was whether or not the portions of the bill that were added on the Senate floor, this is Senate Bill 29, would, in your opinion, require increased appropriation to the Department of Law.
In my opinion, no, sir, they would not.
Thank you. Which is correct?
Yeah. Kevin? Oh, you're sorry.
You didn't work.
Forgetting
you can
it.
Ask him anyway.
We've had a minister in here so much they normally just show up at 1:30.
Could I get some indication? I guess I don't have the list in front of me. How many people would like to testify today?
You want the list?
Yeah, that would be handy. You want to come on up?
I'll make it by the door.
They're going to have down there by the witnesses. I think they can still want to
testify.
Yeah, that gentleman's coming up right now. Yourself and your affiliation with any and indicate the bills that you wish to testify on.
Yes, I am Grim Ward from Glen Allen, and NEA Alaska asked me to come and speak to House Bill 308 and House Committee Substitute or Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 28. I just got here yesterday evening, and so I haven't done a lot of research on these bills. Take them in order. Bill number 28. NEA supports this bill. This is the one where we're going to train public school teachers, public education employees, as to the reporting of child abuse cases. And we feel this is important. We realize that as school teachers, we are obligated to report child abuse, and yet we're unsure as to how to do it and to whom to report it to. Do we report it to the police? Do we report it to our principal? Do we report it to the health, education, and social services? And so we see a great value in this bill and are looking forward to its passage. We did have in Glen Allen about 2 weeks ago someone from Health and Social Services come by and talk to us about reporting. And that perhaps raised more questions than it answered. And our two major concerns, and I don't even know if this is the place to address them or not, are confidentiality and representation. We have been told that a person who reports child abuse will be kept confidential. And that was important to us. And then this person from Health and Social Services indicated, but that if the parents ask, because of the freedom of information, it becomes public knowledge. So we are unsure as to the question of confidentiality when a teacher does report child abuse. And so I don't know whether this is the place to address it or not, but that is a concern of teachers.
All right, Mr. Phillips, just one second. We have Commissioner Pugh and Deputy Commissioner Sykes here, but perhaps they might have some information on the second show.
Mr. Chairman, during the campaign, I came across a similar situation where a parent was trying to seek, first of all, she's got a child, her 14, 15-year-old child. Some neighbor came in and complained about child abuse by a parent, and she was trying to find out where the complaint was coming from, and I tried to even do it, and it was held confidential. And I was told it was confidential. Maybe I missed the boat on something here.
If you know the answer to this, why don't you just go ahead and give us a quick answer?
It's a difficult one because under 4717.040, the reports of harm are confidential. However, in the situation that Mr. Ward mentioned, if the allegation of harm is against parents, either in a civil case or a criminal case, the parents have a right to know about that. They don't, if there's not an allegation actually brought to court, then the department does maintain confidentiality. However, once it gets into a proceeding, then there's usually our rights of the parties involved to know about it, and that would be the parents in this case.
Well, in my case, it didn't go to court. It was
right, and because it didn't, then we are required by 4717.040 to keep them confidential, not subject to public inspection. Probably to encourage people to be able to report without fear of reprisal.
Well, later found out who it was, so.
With the information flow concern, we are apparently back on the air, so everybody can use the button again. We're right now hearing Mr. Graham Ward from Glen Allen, and as soon as this testimony is over, we'll switch back to Anchorage and get final comments from Ms. Feinbaum. Please continue with your testimony.
Okay, so the confidentiality clarification is helpful, and even in a small town such as Glen Allen and many other ones, even with confidentiality, it's sometimes not too hard to find out who the person was, but that's a risk we have to take. The next question which came up was, as public employees, if you suspect child abuse, you're supposed to report it. You can't be sure all the time. You see bruises on the child, and so you report it. It turns out to be incorrect, and we asked this person who was there, well, what happens if then the parent sues you? And we were told this was an in-service day for teachers, and we were told that the school district would not defend us, and that it was the person's own obligation to defend himself. And so we were concerned about representation. If the law requires us to report these, and because of this, a person is sued, we would like some protection.
I think that's probably another question for the department.
Let's pull up a seat.
I think I may need to. This is what the immunity section 17 is meant to provide. 4717.050, that if any person who in good faith makes a report under the chapter is immune from civil or criminal liability that otherwise might be incurred. So there is a section provided to provide that. As long as the report is made in good faith and not, someone would have to prove that it was malicious, knowingly false, some kind of standard that's the opposite of a good faith report. And that would be pretty difficult to do on most reports, since there's a big statement here of legislative intent that reporting is to be encouraged. Good faith would indicate any time you had a reason to believe at all. Does that answer the committee's question?
Yeah, thank you very much. Do you have anything for the board?
Yes. And that answered my question as to the statutes, which we did have read to us, but the question was, what if someone sues you because they think that you had malicious intent? You still have to defend yourself to prove lack of malicious intent. So it is a concern we have, but I appreciate your clarification. The other bill that I wish to testify to is House Bill 308, and this is just a concern as to definition. This is the one that says that we can do, a district can get background checks on anyone who is going to be hired in positions where they oversee children. And looking at the list of crimes, it says crimes that might pose a risk of harm to a child include a violation or attempted violation of present or former Alaska statutes regarding the offense now designated as murder, manslaughter, negligent homicide, and then the rest of the group there, and ends with robbery and arson. We are wondering whether manslaughter and negligent homicide fit the definition at the top of an individual for crimes that might pose a risk of harm to children. Why are the negligent homicide and manslaughter in there?
Mr. Rimberg.
Yeah, we took this up first in a Hess subcommittee, and that language was added, Mr. Ward, as a result of the extensive workup by staff. And if somebody has been negligent, so negligent that they have killed somebody, or have committed a homicide that's technically not murder because it doesn't contain the element of malice aforethought, those are people who have physically, seriously endangered another person, causing loss of life. And we feel very strongly that those are the kinds of people that we ought to know if that's on their record. This could include somebody who has been involved with a very serious, criminally serious, fatal automobile situation or firearm situation, any one of a number of things, and there's resulted in a death.
But you did look into it and
absolutely.
You considered it, okay? And likewise for the robbery and arson?
Absolutely. Yes, we looked into all of those.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Miller.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. Okay. We'll now go back to anchorages. Is Fudge Kleinhoff still standing by there?
Yes, Representative Miller, I am.
Okay, that's real good. Good to hear your voice again. And why don't you continue from where we broke up and broke off?
In the brief pause that we've had here in Anchorage, we've been discussing a couple of Section 10, and I think other people are a little more comfortable with this section than I, and so I'll sort of bow to their general consensus, and as well as Deputy Commissioner Sykes. My overall concern was simply that the way I was reading the bill was that the department could take up to 12 hours to decide to actually take custody of a child, and then add those other time frames on top of that. That doesn't seem to be the way other people are reading that section, so perhaps I was just overly concerned in that area. I think I just wanted to let the committee know that I was concerned about, I think, anything that extends the time between the actual removal of a child from the custody of his or her parents and the opportunity that family has to come before the court to have a determination made by the court. That any lengthening of that time unnecessarily, I would certainly oppose or object to. Then let me go on, Representative Miller. The next section I was concerned about was Section 13, which begins on page 6 of the bill. And my concern is about what I see as a discrepancy between subsection B, beginning on line 20 of the bill, and subsection C, which begins on page 7, line 2. The way I read the bill, people who now have to report would report to the department if they believe that the perpetrator is a person responsible for the child's welfare. But in Section C on page 7, they would report to a law enforcement agency if they believe that the harm was caused by a person who is not responsible for the child's welfare. My concern there is with the implication or the suggestion in those two sections that sort of a rigorous law enforcement approach to prosecution of a non-related perpetrator is what's suggested, but that a less vigorous, perhaps, or not even at all, a law enforcement approach to a related perpetrator is being suggested here. And just as I read the bill, the suggestions of the differences there, where one is to report to the department, and the other suggests that they report to a law enforcement agency, struck me as perhaps unwise, and I was confused and concerned about the differences.
Members have questions?
We've got enough tape.
What we'll do on these is just take note of these questions that you're raising and certainly try to determine if you feel this represents a problem. Mr. Lindberg, I guess, has a comment.
I'm sorry. Pudge, you raised 2 points. And the first one, the second one we heard, the first one we were all shuffling through our papers, we didn't even have the right bill out. We have about 7 bills in front of us. Would you very, very briefly go through the first point you just made a couple of seconds ago?
Yes, I'm sorry, perhaps I went rapidly. My concern was still with House Bill 88, page 6, beginning line 20, subsection B, and page 7, line 2, subsection C. That it appears to me in reading the bill that a person required to report is required to report to the offices of the Department of Health and Social Services when they think that abuse or neglect has been perpetrated by someone responsible for the child's welfare, but they're required to report to a law enforcement agency if they believe that the perpetrator is a non-related person. My concern there is whether or not we're setting up 2 separate standards of ways of dealing with perpetrators, one being a less vigorous law enforcement approach when it's a related perpetrator and a very vigorous law enforcement approach when it's a non-related perpetrator.
Thank you.
I got a flag.
All right, then, Representative Miller, if I may, I'll go ahead on to page 9 of the bill, section 18. I object on line 19 and 20 to psychotherapist patient privilege and clergyman privilege being excluded from people required to report. I believe that the psychotherapeutic relationship and the clergyman relationship should be required to report, just as in the present statute, husband-wife privilege is not exempt from reporting, or doesn't have privileged evidence. Neither does a doctor-patient relationship. I believe that the psychotherapist-patient privilege and the clergyman privilege should be removed from this bill.
We would certainly take note of your comments. That's been the subject of considerable examination, and I think the reason that this exemption is in here is that the feeling is that somebody comes voluntarily to a psychotherapist seeking help in rectifying the problem that he or she may have, that you don't want to make a presumptive 8-year sentence is an automatic result of that seeking help. And so I guess that's the reason for this exemption. But in any case, we'll take note of your comments and appreciate your making them.
Then the last section that I have difficulty with, Representative Miller, is section 19, also on page 9. I know that this section, or most of it, has been in statute for a long time, and I have always had some problem with this section. And I have 2 concerns about it now. One is that while I do believe and understand and have been involved in many cases where it has been necessary for photographs and x-rays to be taken of a child without the permission or consent of the parent, I nevertheless am concerned and believe that a parent should be notified that such action has been taken. And I would suggest that requirement for notification of the parent be given to them. I have a lot of reasons for that. My second concern with Section 19 is with the fact that you are expanding on page 11 the definition of who is included under practitioner of the healing arts. In my opinion, that new list on page 11 includes people whom I don't believe should be provided with such a blanket permission to photograph or take x-rays of a child. For instance, particularly dental hygienists, psychological assistance. I mean, I was unclear about why that's necessary. I think that makes much too broad a permission for taking photographs and x-rays where I'm unclear as to why that's necessary. So those are my 2 concerns about Section 19.
Okay, we thank you for bringing that to our attention as well. Is there further questions from the committee members? If not, we thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Representative Miller, and for letting me get in and out so quickly. Thank you.
Okay, we've got a very definite time problem here. This committee's going to be adjourning in for today until tomorrow morning. In just about a half hour, and we've got 8 or 9 people in Anchorage apparently who want to testify, and then we've got quite a number here in Juneau as well. We'll take 2 or 3 from Anchorage right now, and then I'll try to take 2 or 3 at least here in Juneau. I don't want to cut off anybody. On the other hand, I would like to urge people, if they want to testify on the bill, to bring up things that have not been testified to previously, because if we lose just 15 minutes in the testimony process, it might push us beyond the point where we have to wait another 10 days to schedule this bill again, and it just delays the bill ever getting to the floor of the House. So it's a real problem when we have repetitive testimony. That's not to prejudge anybody's testimony, but with that request to all concerned, I'll go to Anchorage now. We'll hear about 3 more people. Thank you.
Chairman, Representative Miller, and members of the committee, my name is Richard Block, B-L-O-C-K, and I am here speaking on my own behalf, but I am also speaking on behalf of the Christian Science Committee on Publication for Alaska. That is the person in the state who would speak on behalf of the Christian Science Church on legislative and regulatory matters. We have 2 concerns, very narrow and specific concerns, with some of the language in House Bill 88. And in order to put our concerns into perspective, let me just make 1 or 2 comments about the basic tenet of the Christian Science movement as it relates to items in this bill, in order to understand what our concern is. As I'm sure many are aware, a Christian scientist, a dedicated and a conscientious Christian scientist, would rely exclusively on spiritual means or prayer for healing, including of healing of physical problems. They would do so for themselves and for members of their family. We are concerned that there are certain provisions being added to the law which would, if interpreted perhaps in a stretched manner, but nonetheless an available interpretation, might indicate that a conscientious and sincere Christian Science person, parent who is relying on prayer for healing of a physical problem involving their child, might find themselves in violation of a criminal statute. Or a Christian Science parent who seeks the help of a Christian Science practitioner might put the Christian Science practitioner in the position of violating a criminal statute. Now, let me specifically direct your attention to proposal to add 1151.110, and I am referring now to House Bill 88, the 41085 version, and point out that it would be regarded as a crime under that statute if the child were, or if the, I guess it's the parent here, were to expose the minor to physical injury by failing to provide medical attention. And incidentally, my comments concern only the narrow few words, failing to provide medical attention. And arguably, the Christian Science parent who relies on prayer for healing and does not turn to medical science for aid might arguably be in violation of the law. Now, a protection for a Christian Science parent in this regard is already embodied in Section 120. You cannot see that here because Section 120 is already in the law and not subject to this legislation, but that provision is already in there. I have sent to Chairman Miller a letter, which I understand or hope has been distributed to the members of your committee. And in my letter on the second page, I have proposed that there be added to Section 110, subsection A2, language which would deal with this matter. And it says there is no failure to provide medical attention to a child if the child is provided treatment solely by spiritual means through prayer in accordance with the tenets and practices of a recognized church or religious denomination by an accredited practitioner of the church or denomination. I might point out that it was my intent, and I believe it is true, that this language is verbatim as the language in Section 120. And we believe that this is certainly not inconsistent with the objectives that the committee is trying to achieve of protecting children and balancing that with protecting parents' rights. Certainly, we are limiting it only to the situation where a parent has conscientiously sought a legitimate and recognized alternative to medical attention. Pure abandonment is not what we're seeking to protect here. And I believe is a legitimate protection that those of us who have successfully relied on prayer are entitled to. Now, the second point deals with the reporting requirements in 4717. It is perhaps, again, an interpretation that goes beyond the intent of the legislature, and if so, I am pleased, but would urge that at least arguably there is an argument could be made that because a Christian Science, or let me say it differently, a religious healing practitioner, which we regard as being including Christian Science practitioners, are required under 4717.020A to report instances of child abuse. Because practitioners of the healing arts includes religious healing practitioners, they would be required to report instances of child abuse. And by adding some sections which sort of add specificity to that requirement, new sections B and C, section 4717.20, that is to say persons who in the performance of their professional occupational duties has a matter come to their attention, we are concerned that if a sincere and conscientious Christian Science parent brings to a Christian Science practitioner the matter of their child with a physical problem and seeks their help in accordance with the way they are taught in Christian Science, and the Christian Science practitioner renders that kind of assistance, that arguably they are not providing medical attention, and the practitioner would be in the position of at the same time providing prayerful help to the parent, having to report to either the law enforcement agency or to the health and social services agencies involved the fact that there is a child not receiving this medical attention. Now, we do not believe that that is and certainly not ought to be the intent of the legislature. We recognize that what the legislature wants to have is a broad-based obligation on behalf of those who do come in contact with children or circumstances in which children are involved, where there is an abuse of that child, that is to say where they are struck or whatever other the conditions are listed here in the statute, that those be brought to the attention of an appropriate agency. And there is nothing in our there is nothing that we are concerned with that would preclude the obligation of the practitioner to report an example of such an abuse. Where we are talking strictly and solely of someone coming to a practitioner to seek their assistance in providing prayerful help for their child, they are certainly not neglecting that child. They are providing what they believe to be the highest and best care available to that child. Care which is effective and care which has been demonstrably proven to bring healing of physical conditions. And we do not believe that it is desirable that the Christian Science practitioner be subjected to potential criminal penalty for not reporting that single circumstance. Again, referring back to my letter to you, Chairman Miller, and what I hope has been distributed to the committee, there is proposed language, and we would suggest it be added to 4717.020, and we add a new subsection E. And it says, this section does not require a religious healing practitioner to report as neglect of a child the failure to provide medical attention to the child if the child is being provided treatment solely by spiritual means through prayer in accordance with the tenets and practices of a recognized church or religious denomination by an accredited practitioner of the church or denomination. And I would again point out that this is quite consistent with the historic legislative attitude in Alaska, which does recognize that a parent or other person responsible for a child relying on prayerful treatment for a situation such as this, even if it were to get to a court, are not held to be neglecting that child. And I would refer you to existing statute 4710085 and 4710080K, where these provisions are already embodied. So what we're really asking here is that a consistent attitude towards existing prayer for healing be embodied in the new reporting sections, purposes that I've spelled out. And I appreciate the committee giving me an opportunity to state this. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Instead of taking two more from Anchorage right now, I've just been advised that at least one person stood by for quite some time in Fairbanks in another committee, and unfortunately their time ran out, and that person never did get testified. So I'm going to, instead of taking up Anchorage now, we'll switch to Fairbanks and let that person testify. So Fairbanks, if you bring your witness on, please.
My name is Ken Rose, so there's no moderator present in the room. Can you hear me, Chairman Miller?
Yeah, I hear you fine.
Thank you. I do appreciate the committee taking the time, and I know the time has been at a premium for the legislature throughout this session. I'd like to speak as quickly and succinctly as possible. I'm an attorney here, an assistant district attorney, prosecuting primarily child sexual abuse and adult sexual assault cases. I am here, however, in my capacity as a member of the executive committee of the Fairbanks Child Sexual Abuse Task Force, which, as the committee may know, is an organization of volunteers from all the agencies in the area which deal in one way or another with the problem of child sexual abuse, including representatives from the Attorney General's office, the District Attorney's office, adult and juvenile probation officers, local counselors, not-for-profit organizations, police agencies, public defenders, and social workers with the Division of Family and Youth Services. We would like to, first of all, applaud the efforts of the committee and the legislature as a whole in dealing with the problem of sexual abuse in our state, and would like to make some comments specifically with respect to House Bill 88 and Bill number 67. We do support the creation of a hearsay exception. We do not believe that it will be used in every single case, but we do believe that it will be a tool available in appropriate situations. We also would like to, I'd like to point out that the Child Sexual Abuse Task Force here in Fairbanks has some problems with on House Bill 88, page 1, section 2, the portion dealing with sexual abuse of a minor in the second degree. It's the position of the task force that it is, in some ways, it is overbroad. It threatens low-income single-parent families, that there are better ways of influencing the situation within a family, and that it may create an additional risk and burden for child care providers. The task force here also would like to ask the members of the committee to keep in mind that with increased enforcement of the statutes on the books and creation of new statutes dealing and criminalizing with this type of conduct, that there is another adjunct to that, which is victims are continually uncovered. We pull back the rug and we expose the dirt. We attempt to deal with it as best we can. One of the things is that we recognize more and more victims are turned up, and there's a long-term need for counseling and funding for counseling for the victims that we discover in our efforts to enforce these laws. There are two other things that we would like to propose which are not currently in any of the proposals before the state but which could easily be added to House Bill 88. One is that it has long been understood that for most adult sex offenders, whether they're molesting children or if they're raping adult women, cure is not an appropriate term for their long range, as a long-range prognosis. It's rather a control situation. We would propose, under current statutes, the maximum period of time that any person can be placed on probation and have their conduct monitored and controlled is 5 years. We would ask the committee to consider amending House Bill 88 to increase the period of probation to at least 10 years for those convicted of violent sexual offenses or sexual assault on children. This is a proposal which would perhaps over the long run greatly reduce or help control the incidence of these types of offenses and would cost probably nothing in terms of additional funds to be expended. Also, we feel another thing which could be done, and this is the final comment, Mr. Chairman, is that Title 12 could be amended to permit the court to order offenders to pay restitution to victims of sexual offenses nonprofit community organizations which provide counseling for the victim. At this time, if you have a low-income victim who is entitled to or able to obtain free counseling, that person has no financial loss which the court can require the defendant to pay, and he gets off scot-free in terms of restitution for his offense. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. And we'll certainly take those resources you have into consideration. I think we'll take at least one more from here in Juneau. I know we have some people in from out of town. And I'm I guess everybody from out of town just can be here tomorrow night too. We'll go back to Anchorage, and we've probably got time for just about one more. I'm sorry to say, this committee has to adjourn at 3 o'clock. One person will testify.
My name is Pat
Niebach,
and I'm a mother of a child that's 10 years old that was assaulted in July by a 15-year-old minor. And I want to applaud you for the legislation that you're trying to pass. I feel this is a step forward after I have gone through the prison system to find it very inadequate, very frustrating, and I feel that the victims have absolutely no support in the system whatsoever. I am glad to see that the APD unit has been established here in Anchorage. Of course, it did not come into being until November. But in the fact that we went from July, I reported the crime to the police came out and investigated the next day, that same day, excuse me. But the district attorney's office was not even notified about the incident that took place until after another incident happened in October where the child who had molested my child told others in her new school, which they had also moved into our area unknown to us, and caused my child a great deal of emotional upset. And we found out at that time, after many phone calls, that the report had not even been gone to the public defender. The night before it went, another child was molested by this boy. So I feel that there must be a speed up of the trial, there must be speed up of information, and I'm referring to Bill 88 and Section 47, 17025. I feel not only is this an improvement in what we have now as far as the reporting system goes, because apparently this is, I am not the only person, or my daughter's problem is not the only one that's been noticed by, in Anchorage that is had this problem with a delay in the police department going to the district attorney's office. This has happened to several other cases that I have talked with and personally know about. I feel that also the parent or the family of the victim should also be notified that the DA's office has been notified and that the proper people have notified, because I made calls from July all the way up to October time trying to find out information on this, what was happening, and nobody was telling me anything. I wasn't even getting calls returned. Also, the fact that the boy himself, and the policeman told me himself, it was 1 month before the boy actually came in for questioning after we made the complaint. And I feel that is a very bad situation, because the boy was still running around in the neighborhood and was making a very difficult situation for my child. Also, because it all came back up again, the child went through a great deal of emotional stress. The trial, we went through a hearing, we were not informed that like a day or two ahead, that the hearing was going to take place. By this time, the child had repressed much of the information. It was very difficult for her to pull forward. Also, I found out some facts that the police had not even asked her. I had found out some facts. I told them to the intake officer, which he did not even put into the court hearing, which they did come out in the trial, and we were questioned about why this wasn't brought forward. So there seems to be a great deal of lack in the investigative process, and I think it has to be definitely improved. And also the speedier trial. The child, by this time, had gone through so much emotional stress and had blocked out so much that it really weakened her trial. The boy was found guilty, but on second degree rather than first degree. The sentencing has not taken place yet. We have been told that we will be notified when that takes place and what, but I don't have any faith in that because the system has already let me down so many times. I will say that
that the family, if it hadn't been for Star, who helped us through this process of just the tolerance from October on, because the police department had not notified us that this service was available to us, or that there was a support system available to us until October, my child was able to go through it much better. And I do feel that they have been a great help to us. The one thing that did come out to my child also was going back to Senate Bill, the one on the teachers and the health. Apparently, my child had also been molested by my brother back when she was 5 years old. And she told me, this did not come out, though, until after this other boy molested her. And apparently, she had told the teacher when she was in second grade that this had taken place. The teacher had done nothing about it. And I'm sure that my child could have received help and maybe avoided certain other situations that have taken place in her life. And I applaud you on this bill. And that's all I have. Thank you.
We thank you very much for your very candid testimony, and we appreciate your taking the time to do it. With that testimony, I'm afraid we're going to have to end up for the day, and we'll have to end up our teleconference testimony. I realize that additional people wanted to testify, but we just frankly don't have the time. I would urge members, this bill is not, unfortunately, going to move all that fast in the next, all of these bills won't move all that fast in the next day. So I would urge people to communicate with us. You can either deliver messages that will be transmitted down to us through the LIO offices, or you can send it directly to the Judiciary Committee, Chairman Mike Miller, Couch B, as in voter, Juneau, Alaska, 99811. And we'll certainly be happy to receive that testimony. And particularly if you have criticism of the bills themselves that you think are the way that we can construct and improve them, that's what we're anxious to hear. With that, we thank one and all again for your teleconference testimony.
You guys ruined it. I got you coming up with facetious comments.
Yeah.
No. Tomorrow morning, this committee will reconvene at 9 o'clock. First off, we're going to hear a couple of other bills. Hopefully it won't take very long.
In this committee?
We certainly don't need to be here in time. I would say if you're here by 9:30, you'll be here more than an adequate amount of time to testify on or listen to whatever you want to do on these. So you can plan your schedules accordingly. If you want to testify tomorrow, we're anxious to have your testimony, particularly, as I mentioned on the teleconference, if you have suggestions for actual structural improvements in the bill. I don't think you need to sell anybody on the committee on the merits of the legislation, although if somebody has testifying in opposition to it, then I guess we're glad to hear that, too. But in any case, my strong hope is that people will testify in areas of structural improvement that's necessary to the bills.
Mr. Chairman, might I suggest a format for that I think will work well? Three of us have been through an awful lot of this testimony already. And I think what might be helpful
is actually three and a half.
Yeah, take a particular bill.
That's half.
And let's start marking it up and working with it as a committee. And if we have questions, we've got all of our resource people right here, because they're the primary experience resource people on the subject. And then we can call on them for particular parts instead of have them have to present a full blown overview, so to speak, again.
That's what I've got in mind for tomorrow. With the teleconference, I wanted to let people testify on several bills if they wanted to.
Oh yeah, I think that's
And I wanted to extend the signature to the senator so that they wouldn't have to be running back and forth down the hall. But tomorrow, we'll be taking bill by bill, and hopefully we can finish our work on at least one or two of them. I'll remind members of the committee and the judiciary staff that if you want to...
8 o'clock tomorrow morning, right?
8:30.
8:30, where? At St. Anne's.
At St. Anne's Gymnasium, up there in St. Anne's Daycare Center.
It's right over here.
The judiciary committee and the judiciary staff can have breakfast on the chairman.
Good.
Just mentioned it.
Isn't that right up here?
Is that the rules chairman, did you say?
Huh?
On the rules chairman?
Actually, I've been trying to get that. It's this chairman. On 5th Street, St. Anne's up here.
All right.
No, that's not where the hearing is. The hearing is right here.
Don't realize now.
Well, yeah.